Governor Kristi Noem forms a coalition to defend Title IX. Will it block transgender girls and women from the playing field? From SDPB Radio, it's Monday, March 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, an update on the battle over athletics. Governor Noem calls House Bill 1217 a trial lawyer's dream. She also says it's a mischaracterization to call this a transgender sports debate. Lee Strubinger is with us for clarity. We'll also hear from the ACLU. Are South Dakotans lightening up too much on those COVID-19 countermeasures? We have Dr. Wendell Hoffman with us. We look back at Operation Iraqi Freedom for This Week in South Dakota History. Claire Lockhart celebrates artists and art making as Miss Art South Dakota, plus the Grand Army of the Republic on today's Images of the Past. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Small business owners will have an additional year before they need to pay back disaster loans they received during the pandemic. The federal government provided thousands of low-interest pandemic relief loans to help small businesses and nonprofits pay debts, payroll, and other bills. The economic injury disaster loans have gone to more than 7,700 South Dakota businesses. Jamie Wood directs the South Dakota Office for the Small Business Administration. She says the definition for federal loans is different because of COVID-19.
The Paycheck Protection Program and the Emergency Injury Disaster Loan programs were some flagship resources that SBA offers to try to help small businesses get through this natural disaster. And the pandemic is considered a natural disaster.
The federal government reports South Dakota businesses have gotten $476 million in disaster loans. Wood encourages small businesses and nonprofits to apply for loans to ease financial burdens from the ongoing pandemic.
The payments were deferred for 12 months. And so many small businesses and nonprofits that received this earlier last year, they're coming up now on the end of their 12-month deferment period, and so those payments were going to begin. However, recently, through the Biden administration, this got extended, and now SBA has deferred those payments out for an additional year.
Applications for federal loans from the Small Business Administration are open through the end of the year. Remote learning has redefined South Dakota classrooms. Now the pandemic may mean the end of a cherished winter tradition, the snow day. SDPB's David Ozzie Scott has more.
Teachers and students continue to adjust to remote and hybrid learning models, but the technology that lets students learn from home during the pandemic can also let them attend school during a blizzard. Katie Urban is the Community Relations Manager for the Rapid City Area Schools. Urban says the school district is looking to e-learning days as an alternative to canceling school during winter storms. She says while e-learning is a preferred option, snow days are still possible.
It's been a really tough year, and we weren't quite prepared for e-learning. Some of our students didn't take computers home and things like that ahead of the weekend, so we did just give them that snow day. However, it's nice to be able to utilize the e-learning days because that means that we won't have to make those up at the end of the year.
Urban says children have already adapted to the new learning environment. Holding online lessons is often better than rushed or abbreviated makeup days. The South Dakota School of Mines and Technology switched to online learning during the recent snowstorm. Lance Roberts is the provost for the School of Mines. Roberts says this is something the university would not have considered a couple years ago.
Normally, our protocol is to work very closely with the county, Pennington County, to assess whether or not we should actually close the campus like we have in the past for snow days. But in this particular situation, knowing that we did have that ability to offer our courses online, we made the decision to instead go that route and opt for an online day or a remote work day instead.
Robert says the measures put in place during the pandemic allowed them to keep classes going. He says the school will consider making e-learning days more common in the future. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm David Ozzie Scott in Rapid City.
For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem held a press conference this morning in Sioux Falls where she further outlined her position and goals for preventing transgender girls from playing on girls' sports teams. But to call it a bill that tries to block transgender girls is a mischaracterization of the effort, Noem says. SDPB's Lee Strubinder is with us now for an update. Lee, if this isn't a bill designed to keep transgender girls from playing on sports teams designed for girls, who exactly does this effort impact then?
Well, that was exactly what was asked by AP reporter Stephen Groves of the from South Dakota out in Sioux Falls. And he asked, if it doesn't affect transgender women, then who does it affect? Here's what she said.
It affects women. For years, for decades, women have fought for an equal playing field, for equal opportunities, for scholarship money, for programs they can participate in, and to be treated the same as men. That's what Title IX is all about. And it's being threatened by some of the conversations that are happening at the national level, different policies that are happening, part of the decision-making process that happens within the NCAA on where tournaments go, how it's determined, their inclusivity policies, how vague they are and how they've been used in the past. That's why it's important to have an honest conversation about Title IX and make sure we're having a discussion to defend it and keep that right for women out there.
Would this bill affect transgender girls who want to play in girls' sports leagues?
Transgender girls who want to play in girls' sports leagues, it will affect girls being able to continue to play girls' sports. And that's how we believe that girls' sports should be defined.
All right, Lee, how does she envision going about, in her words, defending Title IX?
Yeah, so she's announcing this new group, and it even has a website already, defendtitle9now.com. She's asking other governors and attorneys general and people and athletes to stand up with her and support her. You know, Noem says the idea is to bring together enough people in this coalition to shield themselves from any NCAA retaliation.
Once we have enough states on board, a coalition brought big enough where the NCAA cannot possibly punish us all, then we can guarantee fairness at the collegiate level.
All right, Lee, during the press conference, Governor Noem called the current House Bill 1217 a trial lawyer's dream. But she says the bill she styled and how she wants those changes to be made would hold up in court because it only deals with sport teams within the state boundaries. And she says that's a decision she has full authority to make. So how does Title IX intersect with the legislation as Governor Noem would like to see it evolve?
Right. Title IX comes into play here because schools receive federal funding. And if you look at the text of Title IX and under the Department of Education website, it says Title IX applies to institutions that receive federal financial assistance from the Education Department, including state and local agencies. You know, since South Dakota schools do receive federal funding, state schools are subjected to Title IX. And most recently at the Supreme Court level in the Bostock versus Clay County case, the nation's high court ruled that discrimination against transgender individuals is sex discrimination. And that's in relation to a Title VII case of the dealing with the Civil Rights Act. But Noem says her office has been studying Title IX cases since November.
And we have to do that in a way that we can actually win. We can win the argument. We can win it in court. We can win it nationwide for all of our girls.
Since November. So there's a lot of other things happening in November 2020 in South Dakota. That'll be interesting to learn more about where that started from. But she also took in this press conference a defending her style and form veto during the press conference. Tell me more about that.
Right. So, you know, she defended striking the provision in the bill that would require schools to collect a waiver every year on every student athlete's age and sex and whether they've taken steroids. She says it wasn't the performance enhancing drugs provision, like, wasn't clearly defined. You know, she also said another portion of the bill, which we talked about earlier, creates a trial lawyer's dream. You know, and part of the NCAA discussion had to do with, you know, retaliation from the NCAA. So in the bill, she struck the collegiate portion and what the Board of Regents would be required to do in relation to this bill. You know, she says Title IX needs to be defended and calls it the legal framework that gives women the opportunities to succeed and thrive in sports.
Lee, Governor Noem talked about how long this has been an issue for her and something that she has felt passionately about. regarding rodeo and 4-H and you know, other events in South Dakota. Do you see this as sort of the next national platform for her in some ways?
It certainly could. I mean, when she issued her style and form veto, there were several national conservative groups that kind of condemned her actions. They call it kind of a watering down of the bill that reached her desk. I know some state lawmakers were also concerned about that, too. And so, you know, this sort of move to bring other state governors and attorneys general and kind of bring them all together to sort of shield themselves. I think the idea is to shield themselves from any NCAA retaliation. It certainly mm-hmm. could be a national, you know, sort of talking point. Came up during CPAC. I know the Representative yeah. Rhonda Milstead, who brought the bill, spoke at CPAC, and also former President Trump had talked about this issue as well. So definitely on the national radar, if you will.
Yeah. Lots more to come on this topic, even in this show. Thanks, Lee Strubinger. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lee Strubinger joined us today from the Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hill studio. We are going to have more in this hour about Title IX and about Governor Noem's press conference in just a moment. You're on listener-supported SDPB.
On the next Fresh Air, correcting the record on Lady Bird Johnson. Writer Julia Swag says the First Lady, regarded as the genteel advocate of highway beautification, was far more. A savvy political advisor to President Lyndon Johnson and an advocate of ambitious programs to protect the environment and fight urban blight. Swag's new book is In Plain Sight. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City, offering a broad range of insurance products to protect you and your family at every stage of life. GeneHufford.com.
Since 1985, Fresh Air has presented award-winning interviews covering a range of topics. Host Terry Gross has 50 years of experience hosting public radio programs and is regarded as one of the nation's most insightful, determined interviewers. She sets an atmosphere in which her guests volunteer answers rather than surrendering them. Join us on March 29th when Fresh Air with Terry Gross moves to weekdays at 2 p.m. Central, 1 Mountain on SDPB. SDPB radio listeners are company presidents, board members, and top executives in business around the state. Your company can reach these influential business leaders. Contact SDPB and ask about corporate support.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem spoke this morning about her dedication to protecting what she calls the integrity of women's sports. In a moment, we'll hear responses from the South Dakota ACLU. But first, let's have a little more history and context. Women fought for decades to participate in high school and collegiate competitive sports. Some say that progress is in jeopardy as transgender girls and women compete in women's athletics. SDPB's Lee Strubinger explores how lawmakers across the country are leaning on previous progress to turn away transgender people from competition.
More than 24 states are debating versions of the same legislation. The bills segregate high school and college sports based on an athlete's biology, or more specifically, based on an athlete's gender at birth.
Women are being replaced by biological males. And we want to just make sure that it's fair for women.
That's Republican State Representative Rhonda Milstead of Sioux Falls. She's the prime sponsor of South Dakota's bill. Milstead wants to prevent transgender girl athletes from winning unfairly.
When Title IX was enacted, it was because women had been fighting and girls had been fighting for the right, for fairness in sports. And so for 50 years, and they've been active in sports, winning awards. Their scholarships, there's all kinds of things that happen when they participate as females.
Title IX is a federal law that protects people from discrimination in any federally funded school program based on their sex. Milstead's bill is model legislation that's being considered in other states. While some states have simply introduced a bill, many have referred it to a committee for consideration. However, only one state, Mississippi, has signed a bill into law by the governor. In South Dakota, the bill passed in the House and was revived in the Senate. Governor Kristi Noem says the bill protects women's sports.
Going forward, that fairness is there that was promised by Title IX and what it means to enforcing that in regards to our Constitution as well.
South Dakota's current transgender athlete policy is determined case by case. The State Athletics Association reviews medical information and determines if an athlete would have a competitive advantage. The policy has been used once in the past 8 years, when a transgender girl played on a girls' sports team. The legislative proposals are part of a national effort. Jennifer Braceras is with the Independent Women's Law Center. She supports the bills and says they're designed to push back against states that allow transgender girls and women to compete.
Men are winning scores of state titles, women's titles. I'm not from South Dakota, but my guess is that the legislators see the writing on the wall, that if they don't act defensively, eventually this movement will come to South Dakota.
When asked for examples, Braceras points to Connecticut. There, several female runners filed a lawsuit in 2020 saying they were deprived of athletic opportunities. Connecticut law allows transgender girls to compete on the women's track teams.
I see it really as a defensive act. You know, this is happening all across the country, and it's not fair to girls.
However, some say the bill won't hold up in the courts.
I don't think that you can make those arguments with a straight face.
Libby Screen works for the ACLU of the Dakotas in Wyoming.
I think this is really about something else, and it's about a coordinated political tactic to get discrimination against transgender people enshrined into law.
Screen says the legislative proposals ignore 2 decades of precedent set by the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court.
Discriminating against someone because they are transgender is sex discrimination, and that is prohibited by Title IX.
Despite legal precedents, proponents say athletes born female should not have to compete against athletes born male. Beth Stelzer is with the group Save Women's Sports. She's a housewife, mom, and amateur powerlifter from Minnesota.
When I picked up a barbell for the first time a few years ago, it changed my life. Powerlifting empowered me.
In a legislative hearing, Stelzer told South Dakota lawmakers that competition inspired her to compete the next year. She trained intensely, 2 to 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Stelzer says she even trained around a miscarriage. But she says the event was interrupted when a transgender woman, someone she calls a male, was prevented from competition.
Activists sullied the day of the contest for everyone there. They disrupted the entire event because a male was not allowed to compete in the women's championships.
Stelzer says she never would have bothered training as a powerlifter if she knew she would have to compete against transgender women athletes.
There would be no point.
Stelzer also testified before a North Dakota legislative committee on its version of the bill. Some women are suspicious and deeply disappointed at how women's history has become a rallying point for these bills. Sarah Lampert is an associate professor of history and coordinator of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program at the University of South Dakota.
If you're going to make arguments about women's progress here, you need to think about which women you're thinking about and which women you're not thinking about.
Lampert says those who want to prevent trans athletes from competition point to past policy changes designed to protect against gender-based discrimination. She says this bill suggests that women could never succeed competitively based on sexual stereotypes.
What folks invested in progress for women are trying to do is challenge that gender essentialism and those gender stereotypes and this idea that all women look a certain way, behave a certain way, that their bodies are the same, and that they need protecting. That's crap.
Lampert says at the heart of the bill is a goal to mischaracterize trans girls and trans women by referring to them as boys or men or biologically male. Governor Kristi Noem issued a partial veto of the bill. After facing backlash from lawmakers and conservative groups, Noem says she will introduce new legislation for lawmakers to consider. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
And I'm Lori Walsh. For more now on the topic of assigned gender, team sports, and the Defend Title IX Now Coalition, we welcome Jet Janellis, Advocacy Manager with the ACLU of South Dakota. Jet, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So Governor Kristi Noem said this is not about transgender athletes. This is about standing up for women athletes. When you hear those words, what are some of the things that you would like people to understand about that statement, that this effort is not about transgender athletes?
I think that that statement really can't be trusted. The idea that this bill isn't about transgender girls when it directly affects them and they are the subject of this bill, they are the people who will be affected. You can't pretend that this isn't about transgender girls. And I think it's really speaking to the heart of this issue, which is about how these types of bills, these attacks on transgender people that we're seeing across the country and what we're seeing right now in South Dakota, are about pushing transgender people out of public life, you know. And I think there's no greater evidence of that than the fact that the governor and people who support this bill will basically completely erase transgender girls from the conversation. You know, in the press conference, we saw that without that one question about how would this affect transgender girls, Governor Noem wasn't even going to talk about that. She would only refer to transgender girls as men and males. It's just an extreme erasure and an extreme marginalization, even within the conversation.
In this conversation, then, where would transgender girls play sports? Because we heard a lot about the value of sports and what it means to so many different athletes. What does this mean for transgender girls who want to play on a team? If this legislation and coalition goes forward, they can't play on the girls' team. They're not going to play on a boys' team. Does this erase them from athletics and all those opportunities as well?
Essentially, yeah, it is absolutely erasing them from those opportunities, because when you force a transgender girl to play, to choose between playing on the boys' team, basically betraying their identity and their dignity to play, you know, to play sports that they love in a way that is not affirming and is not, it completely undermines, you know, critical treatment for trans youth who need affirmation, who need support. So it essentially makes it so that trans girls can't play sports.
Is this part of a larger effort that you see nationwide from some prominent women? J.K. Rowling comes to mind, other people who basically are refusing to accept transgender women as women, into sort of this idea of there's an umbrella of womanhood and these people don't belong under it. Is this part of a larger effort to say transgender people are not who they say they are?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is 100% what is happening. It's a highly coordinated attack. We're seeing these types of bills in state legislatures across the country. And, you know, this rhetoric, it's coming from everyone. It's not only coming from, you know, women. It's this highly stigmatizing, demonizing sort of rhetoric that says that transgender girls are not who they say they are, and that they should be feared, or that they're lying entirely, and that they are just cisgender men who are interested in getting some competitive advantage in sports, which is an absolutely ridiculous idea with no evidence to back it up.
Yeah. You can find more about this topic. We had a conversation with Ann Dillenschneider about assigned gender and what exactly that means. Find that on our website. There's also a list of frequently asked questions and misunderstandings about transgender people at sdpb.org. And we'll have lots more on this topic in the future. We've been talking with Jett Donelis, advocacy manager with the ACLU of South Dakota. Jett, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time today.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, are South Dakotans getting a little lax on those COVID-19 countermeasures? We talk with Dr. Wendell Hoffman about the infection trends in the state, as well as the vaccination openings that start today. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
We have gotten reasonably okay with the idea of others knowing who you talk to and where you are for the sake of public health in this pandemic. However, comma.
There is no going back. Privacy is dead. So let's acknowledge it and figure out a better way to move forward.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How do we move forward from here, do you suppose? We'll have that story the rest of the day's business news, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. State lawmakers considered more than 500 pieces of legislation this year. We reviewed the key issues with legislative leaders ahead of veto day. Plus, Peer-to-Peer with Lee Strubinger features journalists who covered the session firsthand. And Seth Tupper explains why South Dakota lawmakers hear each and every bill that's filed in the 40-day session. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Thanks to your support, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is able to bring you live coverage of high school sports and fine arts events. We take pride in shining the spotlight on achievements of students in the classroom and on the stage. Support SDPB now and help us continue to offer high school sports championships and all-state music presentations. Donate at sdpb.org/donate. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, South Dakota is moving on to the next group of eligible vaccine recipients. The state's new infection rate is trending up slightly. Are we doing enough to hold back COVID-19? And could lax behavior across the country cause another wave of hospitalizations and death here at home? Plus, now that more than 37% of South Dakotans have had at least their first vaccine, we're hearing more about the experience of journeying toward immunity. Dr. Wendell Hoffman is an infectious disease doctor with Sanford Health, and he joins us now for an update. Dr. Hoffman, I'm delighted to talk to you again.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
I want to start with this, the 14-day trend, and how we're seeing it kind of head in a little bit of the wrong direction that you might expect, especially as so many vaccines are rolling out and that vaccination effort seems to be going quite well. Shouldn't we be down a little bit lower? What do some of those numbers tell you?
So I think I don't know if your audience or you have ever heard the term, the map is not the territory. I think it's a great sort of description of what we're trying to do here. We all want a map to get from point A to point B or point B to point C, and yet the map is not the territory. As has been famously stated, if I have a map of the Grand Canyon, I know a little bit about it, but until I explore it, I'm not going to know nearly enough about it. So that's kind of what's happened with COVID-19. We've been desperately looking for maps, and what we're doing is we're going through the complex territory of a 100-year coronavirus pandemic. And so there are many uncertainties. There are many glitches, if you will. There are many things that sort of seem to be different one day as opposed to the other. And part of it is that we just have this massive emerging, this concept of emerging science that has been facing us from the get-go, because as we all know, this is not an influenza pandemic. This is a coronavirus pandemic, and so we were kind of starting more or less from scratch. So the slight trend up in South Dakota it does concern us, but again, if you step back and you look at other trend lines in the last while, particularly when you go to South Dakota, when we started dramatically coming down in the middle part of November, it is overall very, very encouraging. But we are not yet to the point to say that we can completely give up on mitigating strategies, particularly in those well-known risk situations, indoor, larger groups, a short distance between individuals, because we still don't know the general number of people who have been who have come down with COVID-19 because of the asymptomatic phenomena, and so therefore it is not yet time to sort of say put down the masks, go back to completely normal time, because of other things that maybe we can touch on here that we're continuing to learn.
Yeah. So when we look at state basketball tournament crowds, or we look at spring breakers in Florida, for example, events that are happening way outside of our control, are we also dealing with variants and things that might surprise us in the days ahead?
The answer is yes and no. I'm not a politician, at least I don't think I make a very good one, but on the yes side, we've seen these variants. So this B.1.1.7 variant, which kind of developed in the UK back in October of last year, it now makes up about 30% of the viruses detected in this country. So it clearly has spread around the world, and it is spreading within the U.S. So that's kind of the sobering bad news, if you will. We do know that this B.1.1.7 variant is more contagious. That's what the studies would indicate. And now we know there's credible, I think there's a lot of credible evidence that it may in fact be more serious in terms of morbidity and mortality. So that's the reason why we can't give up. And if you tie that together with the fact that a big study coming out of Denmark showed that individuals less than 65 had about an 80% reinfection rate, as opposed to those who are 65 and above, when it drops down to less than 50%, we can see that still the older patient groups may be at risk for reinfection. So you introduce a variant into a population, particularly the more vulnerable part of the population, where reinfection is more likely, then you can see that we could be seeing more cases going forward from here. So all of that is to say that we just simply need to be cautious in what we do. Everybody wants this over. It's a topic that we have regularly in our own home between my wife and myself. When is this going to be done? Mm-hmm. I ask that question of myself. I don't like wearing masks, but I do believe in them, and I do believe that they are important to, again, limit the spread. So it's a little bit cautionary, but it is also very positive. A big study out of Israel, a so-called real-world study, which was reported within the last couple of weeks, demonstrate that the Pfizer vaccine, which was the vaccine used in that setting, was incredibly effective in preventing infections, and that was in a time where the B.1.1.7 variant made up 80% of what they were seeing over there. And not only that, Lori, but it wasn't just the 97% number that it continues to be amazing to me, but that it seemed to prevent up to 94% of asymptomatic infections. Mm-hmm. So on the positive side, we have this amazing group of vaccines that may well prevent even asymptomatic infection, which means that they will prevent transmission. So that's the key. And so it's a little bit of cautionary tale. It's a whole lot of optimism, and it's why everybody, when you can get your vaccine, needs to get your vaccine.
So let's talk about that, because the door is wider open on Monday than it was last week as we in South Dakota move on to Group E. That seems to include a lot of people, and I'm getting a lot of questions about, well, does it include construction workers? Does it include, what can you tell us about who is supposed to be covered in Group 1E?
You know, I'm going to have to. I didn't look up my definitions before we had this interview, but I will say to you, Lori, that progressively we're moving towards the entire population that's eligible for the vaccine. So, in the case of Pfizer, it would be 16 and above, and Moderna would be 18 and above at this point. I think we're rapidly moving with 2.5 million vaccines a day. I think in South Dakota, we're going to rapidly be getting to that point where almost anyone who wants to get a vaccine will be able to get a vaccine.
Yeah. At this point, if you're offered one, there's no real reason to say I'm gonna wait for people who need it more to go first. Is there? I mean, this a lot of people in the beginning were saying, well, I might not be the highest need. I'll hold off. If you're offered one, should you just go? If you can, if you show up at the pharmacy and they say sure, should you just say yes?
So depending upon the state-driven criteria, and if you're mm-hmm. offered a vaccine. In my opinion, you need to get a vaccine. What's clear is that, and I think I mentioned this last time around a couple of weeks ago. I mean, if look at the fact that we have almost essentially no influenza this year. I mean, if that isn't mm-hmm. staggering to everybody, I don't know what is. And what does that mean? It means when you got a level of immunity already going on in the population, and you introduce mitigating strategies on top of that, you can dramatically decrease the incidence and prevalence of respiratory borne viruses. So, but that depends also on people getting the vaccine. What is becoming increasingly clear is that natural immunity as promising as it is, may not be as good as the vaccine-induced immunity. And so we need to keep our eyes on that. And it just goes to show you, even for those people who have had COVID themselves, they should get vaccinated. Because what we're seeing is even after one dose of one of these COVID vaccines in a person who's previously had COVID, their protection goes off the charts in terms of the level of their protective antibodies, and we assume their entire immune response. So we need, as a population, to become vaccinated to develop that kind of herd immunity, which is a combination both of natural immunity and vaccine-initiated immunity, because the more people are vaccinated, the sooner we can get back to so-called normal time.
So one more question about that first shot and second shot, when it comes to like the window that you need to show up for your second shot, how firm is that window? Does it need to be, you know, for the Moderna 28 days? Or I mean, if for some reason you have a problem getting to your second shot appointment, can you reschedule it for one day? Can you reschedule it for 5 days?
Yeah.
What do we know about how flexible the second shot window actually is?
So early on, when these vaccines started to be rolled out, there was this so-called four-day grace period between doses. And what that essentially means is that second dose is administered up to 4 days before the recommended date. In this case, it would be you're talking about Moderna. That would be 28 days. So a second dose of Moderna, to use that example, administered 24 or more days after the first dose is considered valid. And to be honest, Lori, I mean, I think if you miss a few days after that 28 days, don't delay, don't reschedule. If you're within that four-day grace period, it's before the date for the 28 days, in this case, it would be considered valid. What we're learning also is that doses given, you know, beyond that 4 weeks or beyond the 21 days with Pfizer, let's say the two dose vaccines to this point, I think they're still going to be effective.
Yeah. Go get that shot and go back and get the second one. You're really saving time in the end if you can prevent lost hours at work from about with COVID-19 for sure.
Exactly. And just one added thing, you know, the AstraZeneca vaccine was just announced that it looks to be very safe. There's really no increase in blood clots, that concern. They're going to be applying for an EUA here in the very near future, and we will have, therefore, a possible fourth vaccine and maybe a fifth vaccine with the Novavax coming not too long after it. So we're going to our country is going to be saturated in the near future with multiple options for people. So please get your vaccine.
Dr. Wendell Hoffman with Sanford Health, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
Well, 18 years ago this week, the 109th Engineer Battalion based out of Sturgis became the first unit of the South Dakota National Guard to enter Iraq as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. 2 months earlier, the 38 men and women of the 109th stepped forward for active duty training in Colorado. From there, they flew to Kuwait and joined the fighting that started March 20th. On the morning of the 23rd, their convoy traveled along the Euphrates River to Talil Air Base, an Iraqi base that had become operational just 2 days prior to their arrival. The story of the 109th Engineers begins in 1924, when they were organized with companies from several communities around the state, and in 1930, Sturgis became their home. The 109th Engineer Regiment was called to active duty in February 1941. The unit trained in Louisiana until the attack on Pearl Harbor, after which they were shipped to Ireland in preparation for the eventual invasion of North Africa. The group landed in Algiers, making the Sturgis Guardsmen some of the first U.S. soldiers to enter combat during World War II. They battled General Rommel's armor units in Africa, were part of the invasion of Italy landing near Salerno, and saw combat through VE Day, May 8, 1945. Following World War II, the unit was called to state duty during the blizzard of 1949 and the Tilford Forest Fire in 1950. Then, some members returned to Europe in the early 50s to manage portable bridges on the Rhine River, with orders to destroy all of them in case of a Soviet invasion. And in June 1972, the 109th saved many lives during the devastating Rapid City flood. During Operation Iraqi Freedom, the 109 was in the Middle East for 4 months, returned to Sturgis in July 2003. Reorganization of Guard units created significant change, and the Engineer Battalion had a formal inactivation ceremony in 2007, ending its 77-year history in Sturgis. The National Guard's 881st Troop Command is now headquartered at the Sturgis Brown High School campus location. The South Dakota National Guard in the Middle East for Operation Iraqi Freedom 18 years ago this week. Production assistance for This Week in South Dakota History comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, history professor at Presentation College in Aberdeen.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. We're learning more about the victims of the shootings around Atlanta. We'll continue to follow that story. And with so many people still working from home, they're buying fewer clothes, wearing less makeup. The beauty and fashion industry hit hard by the pandemic. That's next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. Even the wireless revolution needs a lifeline, and SDN is happy to provide 50,000 miles of broadband fiber support. More at sdncommunications.com.
As we celebrate 1,000 shows on SDPB, In the Moment evolves to meet your needs. Beginning Monday, March 29th, the In the Moment team unwraps an updated version of the program. We'll hear from a wider range of people, focus on topics you've told us you appreciate, and shine a light on the place we call home. Listen to In the Moment with Lori Walsh, middays and evenings, beginning March 29th on SDPB Radio. Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Thousands of Civil War veterans moved to Dakota Territory after the war. Many of them belong to a veterans organization known as the Grand Army of the Republic. GAR members supported one another, lobbied for veterans' rights, and wielded a substantial degree of political clout, both locally and nationally. Well, in today's Images of the Past, we'll look at some of the ways in which the Grand Army of the Republic shaped the South Dakota we know today. Joining me for that conversation, we have Steve Morgan. He's an instructor in the history department at Mitchell High School. Steve, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you, Laura. Nice talking to you today.
So you wrote an article for the South Dakota State Historical Society Journal about the GAR. What made you want to explore that particular bit of state history?
Well, I did my master's degree at Marquette University, and while I was there, I met a professor in the history department who was originally from Canton, South Dakota, Dr. James Martin. And he kind of specializes on the Civil War, and he's the one that got me hooked on doing the research on the Grand Army of the Republic here in Dakota Territory and then later in South Dakota. So that's how I became involved.
One of the things that I find fascinating, and listeners can tune in or can go online to sdpb.org for images of the past, interview and photographs and such, but one of the things that I'm hoping you might talk a little bit about is one of the things that brings these people together is really that combat experience, that wartime trauma, which, of course, today we have different names for than we did back then. Tell me more about that.
Yes, certainly. Many of these guys suffered from trauma. And, of course, it probably... also depends on how much battle experience, you know, they actually saw and experienced. For instance, a veteran could be at the Battle of Shiloh, but maybe they weren't on the front line actually firing a weapon. They, maybe have been behind the line. Whatever the case, these veterans and the organization of the Grand Army gave them that opportunity to go over, to share that experience, whether it was traumatic or not. And this organization became a huge source of solidarity and fellowship for these veterans, especially the disabled ones.
And that gave them influence, too. Talk a little bit about their political influence and the ways that we sort of even recognize it today.
So my first interest, or one of my interests, when I started doing the research was I wanted to see if the organization in South Dakota had the same kinds of trends as the national organization. I wanted to see how many of the men in South Dakota and Dakota Territory were politically active in politics, whether it was on a local or state or a national level, just as some of these guys were in the national organization itself. And lo and behold, I found all kinds of political activism amongst these veterans, even here in South Dakota. So my second area of priority was to just focus on the veterans that settled here in Davison County and had some influence on the city of Mitchell. And so I did that and tried to piece together as many biographies as I could on some of these veterans that were influential here in Davison County. And, of course, there were quite a few. And the one that sticks out for me is a man named George Silsby. Silsby was a veteran of the war, of course. He belonged to the local organization here in Mitchell, post ransom number 6. But he was also active politically. He was a bank examiner here in Mitchell and then went on to become mayor during the years 1900 to 1902, when the state of South Dakota was really under that capital, the state capital fight, when cities like Huron and Pierre and Vermilion and Sioux Falls and Mitchell were all competing for the permanent site of the state capital. So I found that really interesting because he was a go-getter. And he was responsible for bringing in John Philip Sousa to Mitchell to attract as many South Dakotans as he could to this city to influence that vote.
Wow. Well, you can learn more about this on our website, sdpb.org, for today's Images of the Past, and you can read Steve Morgan's article in the South Dakota State History Society Journal as well. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate this. Fascinating stuff.
Yes, no problem. Thank you, Laura, for having me on.
Vermilion artist Claire Lockhart uses her sense of humor while creating oil portraits on canvas that speak to gender identity. Whatever her medium, she brings the viewer closer, even when the subject matter might be challenging. Well, in recent years, Lockhart gained the attention of Los Angeles performance artist Catherine Cooksey. That relationship led to Lockhart being named Miss Art World South Dakota earlier this month. Claire Lockhart currently has a display, an exhibition at Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls, and she joins us now on In the Moment. Claire, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Lori. It's my pleasure.
Miss Art World South Dakota, congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us.
It's an honor.
Yes. Tell us about Miss Art World and sort of what this title really means, because it's about more. I mean, it's pretty comprehensive with her concept of Miss Art World.
So Miss Art World herself, she is a conceptual artist, as you said, from the Los Angeles area, and she specializes in performance art. And the performance of Miss Art World kind of permeates her artwork, and it's a way to challenge like the art world, how women are seen as in it, because women are unfortunately not represented as much as they should be. And it's a way to embrace like diversity and uplift people with it. And I'm just really excited to be included in this family of the art world.
Yeah. So your duties, how does this connect going forward with the work that you do?
So the concept of Miss Art World is performance art, and that just means it is like an ephemeral moment. It's something that can't be bought or sold. And this does differ a bit from my regular work, where I do a lot of oil painting and I also do fiber art as well. But it's going to be a fun way for me to include like the fiber arts that I make. So I do a lot of silk screen on fabric and make clothing, but then I have an excuse to actually wear it and be in public and open up this conversation of how women fit in the art world and also how South Dakota fits in the greater world of art too.
Yeah. And then you recently joined us to talk about this women's suffrage centennial. And so all these things come together. The centennial of suffrage in America came together with the pandemic. That pandemic greatly impacted the arts, and that pandemic and just the economic viability of thousands of artists. And that pandemic greatly shifted lives for so many women as they struggled to, you know, homeschool, remote school, work, take care of everything and everyone. And so many women also, you know, have multiple, you know, I'm an artist and I'm a, you know, teacher, for example. Now all of a sudden, you know, something has to go. So this 2020-2021 cycle seems like a really ripe time for you to step into your role as an artist connecting other women. Tell me a little bit about what this pandemic has taught you about women in the arts, especially in South Dakota, and artists in South Dakota, and how they were impacted by this level of disruption.
Yeah, I don't want to sound too negative, but I, of course, like many other people, was negatively impacted by the pandemic for multiple reasons, especially financially. And I've been fortunate enough that I have space that I can still work, and I have a support system so I can continue to produce artwork. And I just want to share that for people that weren't able to have the creative outlets that they wanted to throughout this last year, it's okay. I remember last year, right away when things were shutting down, a lot of people were sharing the meme that Shakespeare wrote in years during quarantine. But the thing is, we forgot that Shakespeare was a full-time playwright and performer. That was his job. He continued to do his job. And so the expectation that we should have learned a new skill is absolutely ridiculous. I think just being able to get through everything, and you mentioned the extra burdens that a lot of women had to take, or how many more women lost their jobs and had to leave the workforce. It's hard, but I hope to be optimistic and be able to, you know, push back and persevere, and hopefully, I guess part of my personal pep talk is after, you know, the Black Death in Europe, we had the Renaissance come afterwards. So I'm hoping for like a revitalization in the arts once everyone is safe and healthy once again.
Do you anticipate that your art will show influences of this time in some way, even if it is not evident to others upon first glance?
Yes, I'm actually collaborating on a project with my husband, Aaron Packard, and we're calling it Thunder Domesticity. It's a post-apocalyptic wasteland. So just imagine June Cleaver in a Mad Max world.
Sure.
And it came out of, we don't have access to models other than each other, and we can't do the art things that we regularly used to do. And two of these posters are currently on display in our exhibition at the Washington Pavilion right now. They're funny, but they're also important because they're including protagonist women in this apocalyptic narrative, which usually doesn't happen so much.
Yeah. Go to the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls, see that exhibition. There's protocols in place for COVID-19. Miss Art World South Dakota, Claire Lockhart. You can also find her work online and connect with her there. It's ClaireLockhart.com, and Claire is spelled with a K. We'll put a link up in our show notes after the program as well at sdpb.org/news. Claire, welcome. Thanks for being here, and we really appreciate spending time with you once again.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a great day.
That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we've got all kinds of things ahead for you, including Seth Tupper. We'll talk about the days that every bill did not get a hearing in the state legislature. Why did that change? We'll talk about hate crime legislation and that debate in peer, and especially relevant in the wake of recent hate crimes against Asian Americans. We'll also welcome Jamie Metzl to talk about genetic engineering in conjunction with Augustana's most recent Beau Forum. For Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.